show you all this.
This is the Planning Commission work session for Thursday, September, August 4th, 2016.
Okay.
Doesn't matter.
Did you want me to cut screens for you?
If you don't mind, that'd be, I appreciate that. Thank you.
This is the motion that Christian, the referendum Christian, that they're hearing about.
So. So good evening. My name is Susan Wilson. I'm here with Michael Derleth and Sherry Hare to talk about the Transportation Improvement Program. One of our main responsibilities in programming is to manage the six-year Transportation Improvement Program and seek funding for the capital infrastructure. So we like to cover a lot today. I know we only have half an hour, so hopefully we'll get through the agenda. But first of all, we like to start off with the basic fundamentals of the Transportation Improvement Program. Going through the legalities, how a project gets onto the TIP, the ranking and evaluation system, and ongoing programs. Then we like to go and talk about the revenue expenditures. And then we had a work session with our county council on July 17th. We'd like to talk a little bit about that. We road fund background, a couple options for our county council members to consider for our program, and then we'll talk about the next steps. So the current guiding principles for the Transportation Improvement Program is safety. Safety is really the primary role for public works. And then also preserving existing assets, roads, bridges, stormwater facilities, and then paying off debt services. Most of our debt, well, actually all of our debt is Public Works Trust Fund. Most of that is from the Salmon Creek Interchange project. That was quite a large project. We had to borrow to get that funded. And then last, we build new capital projects off our capital facilities plan. So that is our guiding principles in order. So the Transportation Improvement Program is a state-mandated program per WAC and RCW. We have to have our capital projects on the annual construction program, which is the first year of the Transportation Improvement Program. That actually authorizes us to spend money on our capital projects. We have to have a priority programming or an evaluation system. And then every year, our council adopts our Transportation Improvement Program and our annual construction program each year before the budget adoption. That is mandated by RCW WACs. And then last, our Transportation Improvement Program is a six-year program, has to be consistent with the comprehensive plan, the arterial atlas, and the 20-year capital facilities plan. Next, Michael's going to talk about just the basic fundamentals of how a project gets onto the TIP, ongoing programs.
Thank you, Susan. As Susan alluded to, we can't just choose projects randomly. There has to be consistency among a wide variety of planning documents, starting with the Growth Management Act and the requirements to have a plan. There are a number of documents that flow from that plan, keeping consistent all up and down the chain. The adopted county comprehensive plan includes the needed roads and other capital facilities that are in the 20-year capital facilities plan to support, the overall effort. The capital facilities plan is then used to update the annual six-year transportation improvement plan, as well as the annual construction program, which is the first year of each annual year's TIP and sets out the individual programs that are projects rather that we will be working on in a given year. So the comprehensive plan leads to the six-year TIP, which then leads to the annual construction program each year, which includes all of the Capitol Road projects that we'll be spending money on, such as 10th Avenue, the 179th interchange, sidewalk projects, preservation, etc. Any questions at this point? Super. Well, we, as Susan alluded to, in addition to having a list of projects, there also needs to be some sort of ranking and evaluation system that is a legal requirement. So projects in the TIP are objectively evaluated on three main categories. The largest component, totaling 33% of the points in, is about safety. We look at things like accident history, roadway deficiencies. Another 29% of the points available concerns economic development, future industrial and commercial jobs, and focused public investment areas. Another 24% of the ranking points concern mobility. The ranking system looks at links to other arterial and collector routes, multimodal needs such as sidewalks, pedestrian facilities, bike lanes, access to transit, as well as concurrency in roads matching up with development efforts. An other category, totaling about 14% of the available points, looks at the environmental impacts from the different road projects we're considering, public and outside agency support for various projects, and the ability to leverage other funding to advance projects. And more detail on this evaluation system is available in the TIP handbook that goes into great detail on the formulas and mechanics of the ranking system that's been presented here at a very high level. So, well, if there's no questions, Sherry will take over and tell us, there's ongoing programs available that are also part of the TIP. In addition to the larger Capitol Road projects, the county supports a number of ongoing programs in each year's TIP. These are smaller projects that don't compete well against our major arterial projects. Having these ongoing programs is also a huge help in letting us successfully compete for a variety of small specialty grant programs. The ongoing programs include funding for things like bridge repair, replacement and maintenance, road preservation, including asphalt overlays and a wide variety of different chip seals that we apply to roads depending on need. A rural road program includes culverts and safety measures on rural roads. There's a program that allows for the construction of new sidewalks in developed areas, infill sidewalks, as well as new or upgraded ADA ramps throughout the county at various locations. Signal upgrades and guardrail work are typically housed under the Transportation Safety Ongoing Program. And finally, there's an Urban Development Ongoing Program to help identify road projects that stimulate economic development and support industrial and commercial job growth here in the county.
And the advanced right of way, which you didn't mention, is that for future projects that you know are coming up?
Yes, that's correct. So say if we have a Capitol Road project and there's a parcel for sale, and if we have the money to finance that, mm-hmm. that will give us the ability to purchase that piece of property.
Okay. Other questions?
Wouldn't want to leave right-of-way agents out. I was one.
Absolutely.
Very good. Well, in that case, we can move on, and Sherry here will explain a bit about the financial side of our program.
Thank you, Michael. So as you can see, our project cost by breakdown is there's generally three phases to a project. You're going to have a preliminary engineering or a design phase, and that's roughly about 8%. There's also some environmental permitting and other permitting that goes on. Land acquisitions is roughly 11%. But the bulk of the construction project, as you might imagine, is the actual construction itself. And you're looking at roughly 81% there. Our typical revenue that we receive by funding source, the County Road Fund does take a large portion of the burden. We also have the traffic impact fees weighing in at about 7%. Federal grants are at 22%, state grants at 10. The Public Work Trust Fund and loan, that actually in this next go around, we're hoping will be financing 10th Avenue or helping to finance 10th Avenue. And we do have the County Arterial Preservation Program. That money is 2% earmarked specifically for preservation and additional partnerships that we sometimes do have. Now I'm going to pass it on to Susan, and she can explain our challenges to you.
So mentioning earlier, we met with the County Council in July, and some of the things that we talked about was our challenges that we face today. We really have two main challenges. We have an immediate funding issue. We talked about it at our last work session last year with the council. We are having a real challenging time funding 10th Avenue bridging. That bridge is Whipple Creek. Last year we had a 7 or 8 year funding gap. This year we got it down to about a $3 million funding gap. We reallocated other funding sources. We allocated other projects to fund this. We also received a little bit more federal dollars, but we're planning to take this out to construction February 2017, but with this funding gap, we don't know if we're gonna be able to do that. So, and then 119th could be another issue with funding. So it averages $3 to about $7 million that is needed in 2017 and 18. Then another issue that we're facing is the revenue that we have in our program is just not sustainable. Our revenue is not keeping up with our increased expenditures.
Why is that?
I'll explain that when we start looking at the history, because I did a comparison to what we had 10 years ago to what we have now. So some of the major changes, I just mentioned 10th Avenue, that we have a funding gap there. We're really anticipating a Public Works Trust Fund loan of $7-8 million. We've been trying to seek those funds for, gosh, how many years, Bill? I mean, 3-4 years now?
Initially started out at $15 million, and got cut by the state legislature, and then we came back and gave us $8 million, and I got cut by the state legislature.
Mm-hmm. And Public Works, our Department of Commerce, they are mandated by state law to do a call every year. We are applying again for 10th Avenue, but for the whole phase. We're applying for the lower phase from 141st to 149th to 164th to help fund this. We don't know what's going to happen. We also applied for another federal grant of about $2 million. I don't know how promising that's looking. So one thing that we could do is we can look at all of our revenues and expenditures at the end of the year, see where we're at, see if we got more revenue, like, I don't know, TIF, or we get more, we have less expenditure, who knows what's gonna happen. We'll reassess, and then we'll evaluate before we take 10th Avenue out to construction. Another issue another change from the adopted program that was adopted last November is we had an urgent slide project that we have to address. That's gonna cost us about $900,000. That slide is between 50th and 53rd on Santa Creek Street, because this changes from avenue to street, but by Washington State University. And then another big change is the 7 year funding gap with the I-5/179th Street project. We received about $50 million, but the money's not available until 2023, 2025. We really need the money now to start building that project with the development that's going on out there. We've been working with our elected officials to help advance that money. I'm also working with the Washington State Department of Transportation to see what we can do now to start working on maybe some of the requirements of practical design that is a requirement of the House bill for the state funds.
I'm going to actually jump in and let you know that we're actually turning down applications for development because there's not available trips through the interchange area. So it's not an official moratorium, but we do have parcels that are trying to develop that cannot come through the the pipeline and get approval.
Here's that end you're talking about, 179th?
Near the west side. Mm-hmm.
Just
yep, west. If you look at how things were back when we were doing the Path of Parkway, we could get $10, $12 million a year in federal monies that would flow to the state of Washington to fund that rock rail projects. But since the recession, the state has held on to a lot of those funds and kept them in WSDOT for the state highways. So we've probably been about 20-30% of that amount of grants. So there's a lot of politics, obviously, in transportation, and all that has worked against being able to afford the projects that are lined up.
So what is the need on 10th Avenue that is so high on your priority list?
It's the connection between the fairgrounds and the Salmon Creek area. So it's also a safety issue too. A lot of congestion, a lot of backup. It's an alternative route to I-5. So it's and plus there's a lot of development going on up there. Is that right, Carolyn?
Well, the stuff that's close to the interchange is actually being denied in many cases.
Okay.
Because they can't put the trips through there. That's why
the interchange of 10th and 179th?
179th and I-5.
It's the whole system that's impacted.
Yes.
But you have them broken into two separate bullets here, so I want to be clear about funding for each one separately.
Mm-hmm.
So is 10th a higher priority than 179th based on your criteria?
Well, if you look at the evaluation system, all the projects are good. I mean, they rank within decimal.
Okay, they're all good, but we've got to prioritize.
10th Avenue is a higher priority. 10th Avenue is a higher priority.
10th is a higher priority.
Yes.
So statistically, it's more dangerous. We have more loss of property, vehicles damaged. What makes it a higher priority? Is it failing at intersections?
Based upon our evaluation system, 179th and 10th, they're very close. But right now, 10th's a higher priority because we're just about ready to go to construction. We haven't started 179th. We can't do, our program can't handle two large projects at one time. So it's really taking these projects and phasing them to bring them up to buildable phases. So we've been working on 10th for quite a while now. But at one time, we were working on 179th. And we lost funding for that.
What's the total cost for 10th? Ballpark.
Remember, it's about 23 million, I believe.
So it's only a half cost of 179th. So does that factor in the ranking too? That if we can't bite off 23 million, there's no way we can bite off 50 million?
It depends. Like Bill said, in the past, we've gotten large funding sources. So right. If a funding opportunity came up for 179th, we would have started that years ago.
So
it's the funding that is the issue where we can't really start all these different projects at the same time. Because our program is only $30 million per year.
So we did have a financing plan for 10th Avenue. And we worked with a lot of private developers out of the area. And the idea was you get these public works trust fund loans, which have been very successful routinely for the bigger projects. And then we would use TIF to repay the loan. Well, we're not getting the TIF, obviously, from commercial sources now, and not getting the loan either. So it's kind of two strikes on three there.
Well, and the federal dollars too, Bill. I don't think we're going to get the rest of the $2 million we went after. So.
But what happens after a project is to a certain point in design, it becomes obligated and it's not prioritized and it doesn't compete with other projects because we have a commitment to deliver it. And we have pronounced that actually we commit the county to delivering the project. So, you know, it's kind of a moot point. And then the idea is just to build it as soon as you can, as soon as you can get it funded, get it designed, and get it built.
So you're saying we've already obligated ourselves to build 10th?
Yeah.
So we have some kind of financial instrument that obligated us to do that?
Yeah, when you spend 10% of the construction budget, we don't evaluate the project any longer. We put it into an obligated category because we'd be evaluating these every other year, which would make no sense because that'd be a big cost to, you know, a cost of dollars there. So we did obligate 10th a couple of years ago when we reached 10% of the construction budget.
So the concern I'm voicing is based on the idea that it took us a long time to get 179th out of the overlay, and then it was in moratorium, mm-hmm. and we got that lifted, but it sounds like we're moving back into de facto moratorium. There's people that, as long as I've been on the Planning Commission, have been trying to do something with their land that they've been precluded from doing other than just selling it outright for the same use. And I guess I'm wondering about not having a plan to be able to talk to them about other than the fact that we're looking for money.
The reality is that's exactly what we're doing. We're leveraging legislative power. We're having regular conversations with the state about their part because the money that is obligated out in the farther years is on their books. Mm-hmm. And then we're also working with developers. So it's like the all hands on deck to get 179 off the books and rolling forward.
Well,
because it's so big.
Well, and we're still, if you look at the lift of urban holding, what, in 2006, 2007 for 119th Street corridor, we're still trying to get that one funded from 2007, 2006. And that one was quite expensive. It was, if you look, we chopped that up in about five different pieces, but that was about $40 million. We did all that on our own. We didn't have, I mean, we had federal STP dollars, TIB dollars, just our regular funding sources, but we didn't have a large funding package like we did on Patton Parkway and Salmon Creek Interchange because the large funding packages just aren't there any longer. So we've been trying to struggle to keep up with with all the other lifts of urban holding for 119th and then, you know, fit 10th Avenue in and all these other different projects that we're committed to. And then 179th is a really large project that we really need. We really need some large funding package for this large project. Is that making better sense there?
I can be a little bit more straight talk on it too, because what we had for a number of years was a board that had big eyes. I used to say they'd get distracted by shiny objects. Shiny objects being the project du jour. And the TIP has to be approved by the board. And their priorities find their way into the TIP. And frankly, Northeast 10th Avenue would have been the highest priority for staff to put in the TIP. Back some years ago, that was the highest priority for the board. So it went into the TIP. And along with a number of other projects, but then the funding has not kept pace with the demand and the desire. So that's basically where the program's at.
So what I did was I took the revenue forecast and I looked at the past 10 years versus now. And I broke it down into two different categories, the revenue and the expenditures and the revenue. What's changed? So the major changes that I found is preservation used to be $4 to $5 million. Now it's $7.8 million and it's still not meeting the needs. And then on top of that, we are mandated to address ADA and guardrail when we asphalt those projects. The debt service has changed. That went up $800,000 to $1 million. The Clark County Sheriff's Diversion, that was $1.2 million in 2007. Now we're paying $4.5 million. Clean water fees, back in 2007, $1.9. That's gone up about $900,000. And then on the revenue side, the property tax, we haven't received the 1% increase for several years now. Even though it's $300,000 a year, that is an accumulative expense. So the total loss is about $4 million to road fund. We talked about the large funding packages. Now, Bill mentioned that. Salmon Creek Interchange Project, Patton Parkway. We got large funding packages from the feds. Even TIB gave us a large funding package. They're not there any longer. We used to get those every 3 to 5 years. Now it seems like we're getting them every 7 to 8 years. 179th is the next one we have, but it's out 7 years. Traffic impact fees. This is really market driven. So it's really hard to project, but we're 2007, $1.2 to $4.3 million. The revenue coming in is really hard to project. It's kind of up and down. So how we deal with that is we program $1.5 to $3 million per year in our transportation improvement program, and we do quarterly reconciliation so we don't over-program or under-program. And then, so what's left over for our program in the past in 2007 was $13 to $17 million. Now we have $10 to $11 million, and our preservation needs is quite large. So what's left over for our capital program? So that's what's really changed. That I hope that addresses your question.
Yeah, the concern I have is we just finished the 20-year plan, mm-hmm. and projected deficit was $150 million. That averages a little over $7 million a year. Mm-hmm. Seems like the curves are going two different directions. Mm-hmm.
Do you know why the debt service went up? I mean, the interest rates in general have gone down a lot since 2007.
Are you
so
talking
how come about the debt service went up since 2007?
Because we borrowed $22 million for Salmon Creek Interchange.
Okay, so you increased the amount of debt.
It's the increased amount of debt, that is correct.
There's a 0.5% interest. So it's a pretty good deal.
You've got 0.5%. Yeah, I was saying the interest rates right now are almost zero, I mean, across the board. I mean, yeah. Negative in some countries.
Yeah. But the trust fund loan was 0.5%.
Yes. So it was actually.
You would have got that in 2007.
Any questions about this one? So we presented some options for our county council. We talked about delaying or shelving projects, and the next one would probably be 10th Avenue, bridging Whipple Creek, unless we got a windfall of grants. We're not going to know if we get our Transportation Improvement Board grants until November after we adopt our program. So like I said earlier, what we do is we reassess our revenues and expenditures before we let the contract out. We talked about significantly reducing the ongoing programs. We've already done some of that already. So, and then probably reinstate the 1%. That's an option for the council. Reduction of the road diversion, eliminating the TIF fee waiver, perhaps bonding or a combination of approaches. So we plan to go back to the council on August 17th to see, you know, what they're comfortable with and what they'd like to do to move forward.
Is that a work session?
Yes, that's a work session.
You have to know what time?
Oh, I don't have my phone with me.
It's okay. I'll look up.
It'd be Wednesday morning.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I have a
9 to 11-ish, somewhere in that range. Yeah.
So we'll have another work session with our council before we actually adopt the program in October. And I'll take it over to Michael to let him talk about the construction schedule. This is an optimistic construction schedule. It is based upon if we get some additional grant funds for 2017-18.
And as Susan alluded to, you know, there are definitely some issues we're facing, but there's still a lot of construction activity out there that we are delivering and we can be very proud of. The gray boxes that you see on the top of that chart and in your handout are projects that are under construction last year and will be wrapping up this year and next. And there are some substantial ones there. Northeast 94th Avenue, you know, $9 million construction. We're making great strides on 119th Street, another large key project for us. Orchards TSO, another technology project to leverage our existing road and signal infrastructure to a little higher degree. A couple of bridge projects in there, as well as the Northwest Carty Road culvert that, as I recall, took us several years to get organized and get to construction this year. There is a sidewalk project on the list that was requested that we've been able to deliver, and several guardrail safety projects that we're actively working on and bidding this year. And then moving forward a little bit into the yellow boxes, those we basically consider tier one projects that we anticipate will be under construction by next year in this optimistic schedule. Again, some large ones, although we've talked quite a bit about the potential challenges with Northeast 10th Avenue at the top. We're still hoping that that one can be delivered. Another phase of Northeast 119th Street, very large sidewalk project on Highway 99. I believe the biggest sidewalk project that I'm aware of in the 7 to 8 years I've been here. Two more signal timing projects, Wright and Steve, that again are doing leading edge things with our traffic signal network. The Salmon Creek slide repair, and also some work at 99th Street. Moving a little further out into the white boxes, our Tier 2 projects are also planned for construction in the upcoming six-year TIP, but as you can see, we're still attempting to put together the funding for all of those, applying for grants, and as we're successful with grants and perhaps some other methods of attaining the funding for those projects, we are looking forward to moving ahead with them. The green boxes are a little bit further out. Those are the projects that we would like to start some initial design on in the next couple of years so that we can keep a nice full construction pipeline in the outer years of the TIP and not have a big lag in construction. And of course, down at the bottom is our host of ongoing programs for things like road preservation, sidewalks, bridges, transportation safety, and we also do have the advanced right-of-way program, which we will put on this slide before we get too much further, I would suspect. So that's where we're going, and we're optimistic that we can deliver a bunch of this. But we still have some challenges to overcome, and Susan will tell us about the next steps on that trip.
So again, we're going to seek direction from the County Council about assumed revenue. We want to make sure we get that right. And then options for delaying, shelving, reinstating lost revenue, bonding, or combo, see where they're comfortable. And then we'll, on August 17th, we'll meet with them. We'll prepare our next six-year program, or the first year of the annual construction program. And then hopefully October 18th, we'll have a public hearing to adopt our program.
Yeah, you're right. Like, if there are work sessions, we have about 70 active projects.
That includes parks and stormwater.
Oh.
But yeah, we do. And just to let you know, we are submitting about 15 grant applications this year. So we are very assertive on seeking funding. So
the grants that you're waiting for the 10th Avenue, the $23 million, is that funding for the gap or what?
Can you go back to that slide, please?
You're waiting for grant build if grants are awarded. How much are the grants that you're waiting to be awarded?
Oh, so for the 10th Avenue?
Yeah.
About $3 million. That's
okay,
the funding gap.
Is that gap
there.
Funding?
Yeah, that's the gap funding there.
And that's what the trust fund.
Whether you get work, whether they award or not, when you hear?
I'll hear about the federal dollars in a couple weeks. But we are applying for a couple of state grants that can offset some of the money for these to go to 10th. So.
So you're not doing the
not doing the what?
Oboes.
Well, that's still, I put that on the list, but my director took it off, so. And paid toilets, that wasn't acceptable either, apparently.
Yeah. And paid toilets for the PSC.
Why don't you put it on BRP? So you can get some tolls there.
Yeah, so we're trying to be optimistic, and we'll reassess things, and see where it goes from there, and see what the board has to offer too.
When it gets adopted, we can start voting.
Yes, we will. We can do that, and it will be uploaded on the website as soon as it's adopted.
Well, there are lots of projects being done. You drive around, you see that there are lots of improvements being done.
Thank you.
We'd like to thank the Planning Commission
for inviting us. The 99th Street 503 interchange, isn't there work being done there right now? Is that just a preservation project right now?
Are you talking about 503-99?
I'm not sure if it's 99th or 119th. I've just gotten stuck there a couple of times and I can't remember which intersection it is. I thought it was 99th.
Yeah, there might be some. I think WSDOT's doing some preservation work in that area.
Oh, okay.
And so what we'll do is they're lay down the hot mix or the asphalt, and then we'll kiss up to that and complete our project. We're hoping to go out for the construction spring 2017 on that. So
I think they're doing travel lanes with that project. Yes?
That's what it is. Okay, I think so.
It just seems strange that we have this on our project for a couple years out and they have it all torn up and are doing a lot now. It seems like it would be nice if we could collaborate and do it all at once.
I think they actually go through there. They don't, that's not like the end of their project. I think they actually go through. And so they're actually going to just pave the core area.
Okay.
And so they are the higher level road. So that's why we kind of, like she said, we come up and kind of kiss where they left off. Okay. So.
Well, and one of the other issues, just to let you know, we have grant funds attached. Anytime we have grant funds attached to working outside, it gets complicated. So, and we'll, like I said, we'll go out to construction on that probably March 2017 is what we're thinking. So, yeah, design is just about done on that one.
And so our project is about capacity through the intersection. Theirs is about preserving the surface.
Yes.
That makes sense to think of it in that way.
Else, Mr. Wright?
Donation?
Well, we didn't want to mention that.
We do have a GoFundMe site now.
Be careful how you say that.
We'll be working on it.
All right, second item on the agenda, retaining walls. These retaining wall proposed amendments came through with biannual code amendments last April, and there were some concerns with it, and so you wanted to see them separately. So we have made a couple of changes from that, from the prior language. At the work session or the hearing, there was concerns about engineering and building permit requirements. So to start off this section, we added a little introduction. So that's section F1, where this clearly states that this section, you know, basically is land use. It doesn't dictate when you do or don't need a building code. Building permit and engineering, and also that stormwater resulting from construction of retaining wall are subject to 386. So basically, it you know, it puts people on alert that if you're going to be building retaining walls, you have to take these things into consideration. You do already, but this just makes it a little more clear. One of the other concerns that I heard is basically abutting property, neighbor's property rights. There was a desire to put more emphasis on a neighbor giving permission for a wall to exceed the height. And it, you know, it would be difficult to have two sets of codes basically said try to get a neighbor's permission, but if you can't, then you fall back to this. It just seemed, rather problematic of how we would have a two-tier system. And we don't want to get into, you know, litigation or negotiations with the property owner. So we just left it that an applicant can get permission from a property owner, but there are several circumstances, you know, where it would not apply, where permission would not be required. And basically just to outline the main, I think the main things that are more generous to the development community at this point would be starting out, I'm at F, I should have line numbered these on the side, and unfortunately I didn't do that. But starting with the main body, which is on page 3, F4A. So retaining walls greater than 4 feet, maybe placement setbacks, by using a series of retaining walls 4 feet or higher or less, they're separated by a minimum of 4 feet. There was some concern that maybe that 4 foot separation wasn't big enough. I talked to building department staff as to whether a wall with just 4 foot of separation could be constructed without engineering. And it looks like it probably would require engineering. If there was a wider separation of say like 6 feet between this 2 foot, between the 4 foot sections of wall, then it's less likely that engineering would be required. It's very complicated. I'm not about to try to reiterate any of what I was told. But regardless, engineering and building permit requirements are what they are. So again, this isn't going to allow something to happen that currently would not need a permit. It would just allow it to happen closer to the property line. So, you know, so whether you think that that 4 foot is sufficient, because it does allow stacking the way it's written, it, you know, for that diagram, it would allow a fence on top of the second wall, and that could all be within setbacks. Most of the time, the subdivision is going to typically abut a neighbor property line. It's probably going to be the subdivision's rear setback more times than not. So rear setbacks can vary between 5 feet in some of the multifamily zones to 20 feet. So there is a pretty wide variety of setbacks that the developer would have to and does have to currently maintain. So again, that's one of their gripes is that in some cases, if you have a 20-foot setback, you're eating up a lot of real estate. So they're trying to get something that's closer when we're trying to try to come to some balance between, you know, the impact on abutting neighbors. So again, there's already lots of outs that are already in the code. You know, like when you're constructing a subdivision, you can do what you want inside the subdivision because everybody who comes in to buy a lot, those walls will be there. They know what they're getting. What the thing that we're, you know, trying to address is when a new subdivision comes in and you're a neighbor of the subdivision, then you've got a taller wall next to you. So, so if you know, I think the main things that are possible negotiating areas would be the distance between two sets of walls. And again, this is just my opinion. You guys certainly can have your own opinions. So there's the distance between the sets of walls, only 4 feet as written. Maybe it needs to be bigger. I don't know. And there's another provision in here that if a neighbor's property or residence is 50 feet away, then he has nothing to say about it. And you can build right up to the private line. Maybe that's not fair. I don't the letter from Kevin Brown, who testified in the hearing, brings up that very point. Let's see. Also, as it's written now, on page four now, right now it says that you could go up to a property line if the property next to you is commercial or industrially zoned. So there could be some circumstances where somebody lives on a commercial or industrial zone property. They're living there, they're resident. They have no intention of developing, at least for a while. They still wouldn't have anything to say about it because their property is zoned commercial or residential. A possibility would be that change that to commercial or residential uses that are already ongoing. So that would be another possibility. One of the other things that is different from the version that you saw in April is that there was a section where the responsible official, planning director, could approve variations that were unforeseen in this code. And based on some of the discussion where we thought it was important that neighbors have a say in what goes on, we thought that it might be a good idea to just eliminate that section. It seems like it's opened up quite a bit. And so if this isn't good enough and you have to get quote-unquote variance to it, then it should maybe just be a variance. And if it would be a type 2 variance, basically over 25% of the standard, then the neighbors would get notice of it. So, and frankly, you know, Marty wasn't thrilled to be in a position of being pestered by the developer saying, well, this doesn't mean it, but it's okay, isn't it? And then he would have to make a somewhat arbitrary decision. And so we kind of like to stay out of having that power or flexibility, as it might be called. So I think I've hit the high points of the differences.
You say here that he endorsed the majority of the proposed changes.
Yes. Well, they did not see the section one that I added regarding building codes and engineering, but I can't imagine they would object to that. The last thing was that the last version they saw, the development planning director did have the ability to approve variations. That's one of the things, you know, they don't want to go through variances if they don't have to. So that's something that they have not seen. I did notify them of this potential change. You know, they may show up for hearing.
So you sent them this new,
yes,
this report here we've got in our hands.
Yeah.
It looks like they looked at it in March. That was before we looked at it. So they haven't seen the new.
They haven't seen the new stuff.
The new stuff, but
no, but if they have now, I mean, they haven't discussed it any DBs because there haven't been any.
Yeah, will there be one before our hearing?
No. They didn't have one. They're not having. It would have been today, typically. So, but
okay. But you did send them. Did they have
this
report?
I sent them the text.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, the whole report.
Is there any allowance for repairing, like a failing retaining wall that would maybe exceed these standards that was built previously in other areas of code?
That's a good question. I think if they're already there and they were, you know, legally done, then they
probably
could do that. I think we'd make them.
I mean, I'm thinking, so I have a specific example. I have some clients that bought a house with a failed retaining wall on one side of the property that is growing at 4 feet. It has to be within the setbacks. I mean, it's the house that was built to that property edge. So I'm just wondering, would they have an issue going to get the permits or going through this to repair that failed retaining wall because now it does exceed the requirements?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think anybody ever thought of that. Well, as it is now, I mean, if we were to be strict the way it is now, it wouldn't be allowed if we said, oh, sorry, new code doesn't allow it, so you can't rebuild it. I think we would generally look favorably on that because everybody's been living with the situation. It's not like something new is going to pop up. So I would imagine we would be able to approve something like that, as long as it isn't any worse. One thing to note is that in the biannuals, the height of fences that can be built without a building permit did go up to 7 feet. So that basically has been approved. So if, and it's kind of something different, but if you approve nothing else, just be aware that with the biannual change, people can build fences up to 7 feet tall. And if nothing gets changed in this code, then yeah, you can build a fence up to 7 feet tall without a permit, but it's gonna have to meet setbacks. Because right now the limit is 6 feet. So that's something to consider, please. So what do you think?
Are the things that Mr. Brown, I mean, I see this letter here, and I was trying to remember if all of the issues that he had when he testified. We do have his testimony now. I was trying to look at it again.
Is this the letter he submitted to us back at the Planning Commission?
Yeah.
Has he seen this? Does Mr. Brown have
it? We sent that to him, yes.
And has he responded yet? Or?
He has not. I mean, this just went out yesterday.
All right, yeah. Probably one time, not until the hearing.
So it seemed like, you know, when I was hearing his story, it seemed like quite a bit of it is stormwater related.
Yes.
You know, and I'm really not clear if some of that wall was built below, you know, I think it was built without a permit. And so maybe it wasn't addressed as it could be, you know, or should have been. But I mean, if you're building these things, no matter if you're meeting setbacks or not, you know, the setback could be 5 feet. So this same thing could go up 5 feet in your property line if that's what your setback is. So engineering needs to be, and stormwater does need to be addressed regardless where it is.
So Jan, on the last page, D2, where we say walls and or fences over 12 feet high will be reviewed for potential shading and visual impact beyond the right of way or easement. Do we have specific definitions about when a person is in or out of the criteria for shading and visual impact?
No.
No, it's for margin to be arbitrary.
Right, right. But as it is right now, we don't have anything at all. You know, right now you can build a retaining wall of any height against an easement or right-of-way. And there's no consideration at all. This gives us some hope of putting some conditions on that.
So when this says 12 feet high for the walls, and this is saying we have like 4 foot max, does that mean that's 3-tiered to get up to 12 feet?
Well, this would be a different situation because this section D is dealing with current exemption. So basically it says retaining walls or fences abutting a road right of way or road easement do not have to meet setbacks. So you can, right now, if a development has frontage on a right-of-way, they can build the retaining wall of any height right up to the right-of-wall or even to an easement. So
they have a pretty high one on 192nd. This in the city, I think. But if you ever drive up 192nd, there's like a 30 or 40 foot retaining wall right, yeah. Goes right down to the sidewalk.
On the street?
Yeah.
On the west side? The 192nd?
It would be the east side.
Yeah, some of those subdivisions, again, in the city and Camas have some pretty huge ones in the neighborhood, and they're both on the hillside.
Yeah. But I mean, that's a challenging area. I mean, that there used to be big rock. I mean, they've taken the whole area down. I mean, it's they've terraformed that whole area.
Right at where you come off.
Right when you get off the and you sweep up the hill. There's an enormous retaining wall. They did a decent job designing it. It's all sort of architectural. So it looks like a natural rock wall.
Right.
But it's not. It's concrete.
So in a steep scenario where a housing development is at the base of a hill, but now they want to develop above the hill and they have to put in retaining walls, there's really no limits to these steps, but they may have to do many steps beyond just the example here.
If I understand you correctly, if your property is here and there's a hill in front of you, you can dig into the hill and put a retaining wall of any height right now, because there's a somewhat ambiguous section that says that it only applies to, back on page 3, section F4B. If the exposed faces of the retaining wall over 4 feet in height are directed towards the interior of the lot, then there's no height limit. So basically, you can create the retaining wall that you're looking at of any height.
But it doesn't belong to me. I guess that's what I'm saying is the housing tract is at the lower level, but now the abutting property is like that, and they want to develop up here. They need to terrace up?
If they're filling it. I mean, if there were... So that slope would be an existing slope?
Yeah.
And they just want to retain it, to keep it from
going into their potential neighbor's backyard now that they've disturbed everything and built on top.
Yeah.
It's undisturbed dirt, so it's terrace.
Yeah, I don't. Again, that wasn't. I don't know if we consider that a retaining wall.
I think it's got to meet the setback standard according to this.
Yeah, but if the property line goes right down, they would have to dig it out to meet setbacks, right? I mean, if there's already existing hill there, and you're just armoring it, you're not creating a new mass. You know, you're just sort of.
No, the mass is going to be up on top, I guess, is my concern. What I'm actually just thinking about is in the context of when we have these properties up above sliding down into like what happened in Longview as an example.
Trying to keep your slope from.
But it belongs to the uphill property. It doesn't belong to the lower development.
Right. And as I read this, you'd get 8 feet total within the setback when you're doing that, separated by 4 feet. You got 4 feet. 4 feet, so a total of 8 feet, and then any other walls you want to build under those circumstances are going to be outside the setback.
I guess that was probably the first reason that we had some sort of variation in there to be able to approve common sense kind of things, you know. I mean, if the mass is already there, and you're just, but that could be something that maybe we could put some language together for. That's a good point. Yeah, it hasn't been easy, truthfully. It's put a lot of effort into it. I know it's not perfect, but it's something.
What created the idea?
Well, developers have come to us in the past saying, "What? I got a 20-foot setback that I have to meet."
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it can be impacted, you know. So we try to come up with reasons why, you know, where it really shouldn't matter. And then those cases where a neighbor is living next to it, you do have the opportunity to get that permission from them. And, you know, hopefully that can be done, and if not, they have to be more creative.
Where did this, is this something you guys put together?
Yes, yeah, something I drew, just okay. To sort of illustrate
what's allowed under the new.
What is allowed under, you know, under the proposed code. So that kind of illustrates F4A. So the steps and the wall and the fences on top of the steps. It probably would be a good idea to have, if this gets approved, is to have a diagram more nicely done than that to illustrate what it means, because it's not the easiest thing to describe.
Yeah, I would add, like, on the bottom, a little arrow that shows setback.
Right.
Like, I mean, it says it in the text here, but I think visually, if you have it,
right.
It would make it a little more clear.
Is a owner of the property that we're doing the retaining walls, is he allowed to put a 3.5-foot fence on the first section also?
Yes. Yeah. So if you could build under this scenario, you could just move the fence that's on the upper wall, put it on the lower wall, and, you know, if you didn't have the second section at all. So you could have a 4-foot wall, 3.5-foot solid fence, which would be a total of 7.5 feet to grade. Or if you had an open fence, like chain link or iron, something like that you could see through, then you could put a 7-foot fence on top of it, so you'd be at 11 feet total height.
Could you put a fence on both? Or are you prohibited from putting that would do that. I mean, that would look really weird. But.
Right. Well, I can see why sometimes if the public's going to have access to this, you'd want to have a fence so people don't fall over. You know? And that's why the 3'6" number was chosen, because that's the height of a guardrail.
So you could have a fence on both if you wanted. But that would create a really narrow strip in between the two fences.
Right, yeah.
I suppose you had a bunch of trees and shrubs growing there, so it wouldn't really matter. As long as you
that's part of it. If you do this, you're supposed to landscape it.
Especially if you got a solid fence here, then he's nice and private.
Yeah.
And they could just string a tarp from the top one fence to the top of the other fence, and the rain would drip off to the side. And
your stormwater
ratio. That's true. Yeah, that can cause a stormwater problem. More impervious surfaces.
Well, I appreciate the effort you put in. I think, you know,
well, yeah, if it was
the longer you ponder it, the more of the what if scenarios there are.
It could be 10 feet.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess it's a matter of, do we feel the need to put something in as rapidly as possible, or, you know, will our hearing bring out more concepts or ideas?
You know, another, you know, option that I haven't thought about is just make it simple. You know, do something like instead of have a certain maximum distance that they have to be set away, you know, instead of 20 feet, maybe just make it 10 feet, you know, make it either the setback of the zone as it is now, which can be as small as 5 feet, or you could increase it to something reasonable. I don't know. That would make it simple. It wouldn't make all the developers happy, but it would get rid of the worst circumstances.
So by you saying that, would that replace then the placement of the wall from this potential property line to the setback line?
Well, if I would say, to me, the idea of the fence, right now, there's no code that deals with the fence on top of the retaining wall. The current interpretation is that you measure the fence from the top of the fence to the grade. So you only get 6 feet right now, 6 feet total. You get a fence and then like a very short retaining wall underneath it. Perhaps allowing the fence on top of a 4 foot wall would be an improvement. And then if you didn't want to deal with any of the rest of this, you know, you could say, okay, you still have to meet setbacks except for the fence on top of the 4 foot wall. Everything else would have to be setbacks. But if you have like a 20 foot setback, that's too much. You can go to 10 feet. Yeah, so you can say either meet the setback of the zone up to a maximum of so many feet. I probably shouldn't have brought that up. But, you know, I mean, it does get complicated, you know. Food for thought, if you guys want to bring that up.
All right, anything else?
All right, well, that's all I got.
Any other questions? I guess that means we are adjourned.
All right. No hurry.
Well, congratulations to both of you. I read in the paper, you guys did well.
She won. I just.
You won out.